Lying, Liars, and the Voters Who Love Them, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Special Counsel Robert Mueller finally breaks his silence on the Russia investigation, and he says that according to Justice Department policy, his team could not charge a sitting president.
Charging the president with a crime was therefore not an option we could consider.
We'll hear what that could mean going forward for Trump and for Congress. Also, the frontrunner to become Britain's next prime minister has admitted to playing the fool in the past.
Because the reality may be that you don't know what is going on, but people won't be able to tell the difference.
But now Boris Johnson is facing a real trial on a charge that he lied about Brexit. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Special Counsel Robert Mueller ended more than 2 years of silence this morning.
Now, I hope and expect this to be the only time that I will speak to you in this manner.
He then highlighted for reporters a few key takeaways from the massive report his office wrote and released last month, summarizing their investigation of Russian interference in the 2016 election and connections to President Trump. Mueller did not clear up the did he or didn't he questions that linger around the president. On the one hand,
there was insufficient evidence to charge a broader conspiracy.
And on the other,
if we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so.
Mueller did take pains to explain the limits to what his office could do.
A president cannot be charged with a federal crime while he is in office. That is unconstitutional. Even if the charge is kept under seal and hidden from public view, that too is prohibited. The Constitution requires a process other than the criminal justice system to formally accuse a sitting president of wrongdoing.
He's referring to a possible impeachment process.
That's Kimberly Welly, a law professor who knows quite a bit about presidential investigations. She was associate independent counsel during the Whitewater investigation of President Bill Clinton.
Under the Constitution, a president can essentially be fired through an indictment and a trial process that occurs actually in Congress and not in the criminal justice system in a court. Alternatively, in 2020, American voters can decide this man does not belong in office another 4 years. And then if the statutes of limitations have not expired on possible crimes, including obstruction, Mr. Trump, the private individual, could still be charged and indicted and tried criminally in the criminal justice process.
Yeah. So what you're saying is when Trump is no longer a sitting president, perhaps there would be further legal action at that point?
There certainly could be, because Mr. Mueller was clear to say that if his team had confidence that Mr. Trump did not commit a crime, they would have said so. So that leaves open a real question as to whether he did commit a crime. And I think many former prosecutors have read the full Mueller report and determined that based on the information in the second volume on obstruction, there's ample evidence to charge the president with a crime. So if he does not get a second term, potentially the statute of limitations would not have run, and the Justice Department could charge Donald Trump as a private citizen with the crimes that are potentially underlying the Mueller report.
Did you learn anything, Kimberly, that was new on the question of obstruction of justice, listening to Mueller today?
I did not learn anything new. What I thought was interesting is that he rephrased his report when it comes to obstruction of justice. He said, we weren't in a position to exonerate the president. Today, what he said was, if we had confidence that he did not commit a crime, which is much more layperson's language, then we would have said so. And he did not repeat the exoneration phrase that was in the report and that was in Bill Barr's summary, initial four-page summary of the report, this concept of exoneration. He said, listen, if that we had confidence that he did not commit a crime, we would have said so. So the big question is, did he commit a crime? And he lays out the evidence in the report and says, listen, Congress, go with it. Look at this. It matters. And we'll just have to see how the political process shakes out going forward.
Yeah, all those comments today from Mueller, I mean, it felt like he was coming close to talking about impeachment, but not using that specific word. What do you think his statements, his comments today will do to the discussion on Capitol Hill about impeachment?
You know, it sounds like the president's initial tweet in response to Mr. Mueller's was pretty subdued for this president. He said there's insufficient evidence of a crime. That's very different from it's a hoax. These are all unethical, biased attorneys. Mueller made it very clear this was, you know, these are good people. They're fair and independent minded. And so I think this bolsters politically the Democrats' position that investigation of this president is legitimate. And as a constitutional law professor, it has to be that way, whether it's this president or someone else. My position is there has to be accountability for any government official.
Do Mueller's comments today provide any new information or detail to members of Congress that was not in the redacted report that was made public recently?
No, but what I think he does do is reframe the narrative in a manner, frankly, that would have been appropriate from Mr. Barr at the outset. Mr. Barr said there was no determination that there was any collusion. Mr. Mueller today made clear that there was insufficient evidence to charge a broader conspiracy. Conspiracy is a legal term, collusion is not. He also made the argument that obstruction of justice is a legitimate inquiry. It's of critical importance, he said, because it strikes at the efforts to find truth and hold people accountable. So I think Mueller's independence, Mueller's judicious, measured approach, his fact and law approach, his apolitical approach, all of that is almost the grandfatherly sort of thoughtful mentor coming in to the American public and saying, listen, this is the bottom line. And I think he's handing off a baton that sort of clears a little bit of the political noise and the distortions, frankly, that have been, I think, making it their rounds in the American discourse in a way that's really not helpful to the rule of law or to our separation of powers.
We've been kind of chatting about the headlines from 10 minutes of Mueller speaking today, Kimberly. What else stood out for you?
It stood out for me that he opened and really closed his statement with the question of Russian interference in the 2016 election.
There were multiple systematic efforts to interfere in our election. And that allegation deserves the attention of every American.
Deserves attention in the present tense, not deserved in the past tense. And I think we need as a nation to focus on the integrity of our electoral process. The Congress and the president should get behind that and put the money into it that's necessary to ensure that we've got a bullet-tight electoral process. We do not right now. And so we could see a redo in 2020 of what happened in 2016. And I think if you read between the lines, that's what Mueller was saying. This is really serious. And that should be the headlines going forward, not the he said, she said with respect to Mueller and Barr. And I'm hoping that Mueller's statement today will be how the report itself is framed going forward.
Kimberly Welle, professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. Thanks very much for this.
My pleasure.
Meanwhile, in Britain, a high-profile politician is straight up going to trial for lying. Boris Johnson, you might know him, acts kind of goofy, unruly mop of blonde hair, known for his bloopers and his support of Brexit.
Think what we could do if we had proper free trade deals.
And, he's a frontrunner to succeed Theresa May as the UK's next prime minister. Over time, Johnson has been called a lot of things. A sly fox, the British Trump, the clown prince, and yes, a liar.
Why did you lie to your party?
Well, I mean, again, I mean, with great respect, on that, I never had it.
Johnson himself admits to using artifice sometimes to get what he wants.
Well, I certainly think that as a general tactic in life, it is often useful to give the slight impression that you are deliberately pretending not to know what is going on, because the reality may be that you don't know what is going on, but people won't be able to tell the difference.
So you could say Boris Johnson has a long history of bending the truth, and now it could be catching up with him.
I, Marcus J. Ball, private prosecutor.
Marcus Ball is a private citizen, and he's bringing a criminal case against Johnson. That is something you can do in the UK. The charge is misconduct in public office. And my BBC colleague Dominic Casciani says the case involves a legal concept that has its roots back in the 13th century.
It's an ancient offence, and in effect, somebody can be found guilty of this offence of misconduct in public office if a prosecution can prove that the official willfully neglected to perform their duty or misconducts themselves to such a degree that it amounts to an abuse of the public's trust in that person as an office holder. Rather surprisingly, you may find, the offence can lead to life imprisonment in theory, But I doubt there's anybody who's actually charged with this in the modern day would ever face anything like that. Now, today's developments with Boris Johnson, the possible future Prime Minister of the UK, being summoned to face this allegation, you know, I mean, it's quite a turn of events.
Who is accusing him?
He's been accused by a man who has said for a number of years now that Johnson's been lying. Now, his name is Marcus Ball, and he's effectively been crowdfunding a campaign to bring a private prosecution against Boris Johnson. And Mr. Ball began this case a couple of years ago, effectively accusing Boris Johnson of lying over a very important part of the EU referendum campaign in the UK.
Dominic, we just saw Brexiteers start their own party. Boris Johnson himself is in the front running, as he said, for Prime Minister. I mean, it's easy to imagine these accusations are ginned up by his opponents and by Brexit opponents. What is Boris Johnson saying about this charge?
Well, sources close to Boris Johnson are saying that the prosecution is nothing less than a politically motivated attempt to reverse Brexit and crush the will of the people. You know, he effectively says that, you know, Marcus Ball's plan has been to overturn the referendum via a legal challenge. So, in other words, his target is the referendum result rather than Mr. Johnson himself. And in effect, he's arguing that there is a freedom of speech issue here, that whatever you think of Mr. Johnson and what he said, he had the right to say it as a political campaigner. You know, what this all comes down to is a very famous element of the EU referendum, which was a claim that the UK was sending £350 million every week to the European Union. Now, this tentative prosecution against Mr. Johnson claims that not only was that untrue, but Mr. Johnson knew it to be untrue, and therefore it was a lie, and it was a lie that had a really key effect on public opinion.
It is an interesting contrast to what we heard from Robert Mueller here in the States earlier today, emphasizing that an elected official, in this case the president of the U.S., cannot be indicted while in office. What will this do to the gas in Boris Johnson's prime minister tank?
This is the million-dollar question in many respects, because I imagine that some of his closest supporters will use this as ammunition. They will see this as an attack on them and on the stand to get the UK out of the EU. The key issue, of course, for Boris Johnson's opponents is that now that he's effectively been summoned and accused of a criminal offence, they've got to also be very careful about what he says, because the UK has a law called contempt of court, which means that if somebody's accused of a criminal offence, you have to be very careful about what you say about them so that they are, you know, ensured a fair trial free of prejudice.
What impact will these charges have on the Brexit debate itself?
I think this case, if it goes ahead, may in some respects become one of the kind of resolving points of the whole argument about Brexit, because the argument over this figure that was put out during the referendum that the UK was sending £350 million a week to the EU, this became a very, very poisonous debate in the UK back in 2016, and it's one of the legacy issues of the referendum, where a lot of Remainers say that figure was either downright wrong or a willful lie by people who used it. So if this case goes all the way before a jury, and the jury, you know, comes to a decision one way or another, you're going to have people on whichever side of the Brexit debate saying, well, I told you so. But it's going to be extraordinary if it comes down to this moment of one of the biggest Brexit figures in court and a jury of 12 men and women, you know, having to decide ultimately his fate and ultimately, you know, the truth or not of a key element of the campaign, which, you know, potentially will take the UK out of the EU.
That would be wild. The BBC's Dominic Casciani, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. Hundreds of prisoners held by ISIS have been freed since the fall of the self-proclaimed Islamic State Caliphate in Syria. That includes Yazidis, members of a Christian minority who were captured when ISIS swept through their homeland in Sinjar, northern Iraq. Many, if not most, of the men were murdered and buried in mass graves. The women and children were enslaved. Only some of them survived their captivity under ISIS fighters. My BBC colleague Quentin Somerville has a story of one family. That story begins in northern Iraq.
In a Yazidi safe house in the Syrian countryside, a boy plays on a swing. His name is Nashat, he's 11 years old, and he's just escaped the horror of Baghouz, where the Islamic State made its last stand. For 5 years he was their slave.
They would buy us children, no matter what age, and make us servants. They treated their children nicely, like a piece of gold, but they kicked us out at night to sleep in the garden or the sheepfold. I don't know why they would buy us if they didn't want to look after us.
The first time we spoke, he could barely remember Kurdish. The trauma he endured is almost unimaginable. Baghouz was an inferno at the end. He was taken on August 13th, 2014, from the Yazidi homeland of Sinjar in Iraq with his mother, sister and brother. His mum was pregnant. She was sold to six different IS fighters and their wives. After a year, she was sold without Nashat. Shortly after, his sister was sold too, and he was left alone with monsters.
There was a person called Abu Nasser. He would always beat us, no food for a month, only a piece of bread once a day.
But what of the rest of his family? Had they survived the chaos and the terror of IS rule? Some grainy mobile phone footage from 4 years ago records the release of Nashat's mother, Fawzia. For a ransom, she was smuggled out of Syria with her two children into the arms of her waiting husband. But it was a bittersweet moment. Then Nashat and his sister Jolene were still in Islamic State Group's grip. Given refuge in Germany, there was no relief and freedom for Fawzia, while her two oldest children were still in Syria.
We visited psychologists. Nights did not pass without tears. We couldn't enjoy delicious meals or buy nice clothes for the other kids. It was the most difficult 5 years.
Her years of captivity, being passed from IS fighter to fighter, many of them foreign, was a daily torture. The wives of IS fighters were especially cruel.
Abu Naif bought me. They called him the Emir of Real Estate in Raqqa. He was married and bought me as a slave for his wife. She was so bad and treated my kids awfully. She beat them and locked them in the bathroom.
But her family was coming together again. In March this year, with the help of a people smuggler and another ransom, Jolene was found and brought back to Iraq. So last week, Fawzia was at Frankfurt Airport, heading to Iraq to see, finally, her two missing children.
I'm sitting under the fluorescent lights of Erbil International arrivals. We're waiting for a flight from Frankfurt, Iraqi Airways. Nashat's here, as is his sister Jolene. He's bouncing around the walls. He's super excited. He's wearing his brand new bright red shirt, and Jolene, his sister, she's a lot quieter, in a little pink dress with glitter. And they're both staring intently at the doors, waiting for their mother to arrive.
Finally, their mother arrives, scooping them up with sobs and showers of kisses. For the first time in years, the family can sleep without fear under the same roof.
We all know the Islamic State Group's crimes on the battlefield, but this is where it's really felt. They tried to destroy this family. They tried to wipe out the entire Yazidi people, but they didn't. They failed. The Islamic State Group's on the run now, but the pain and the suffering that they've caused has been amplified for tens of thousands of families here in Iraq and in Syria too. And that's going to take generations to recover from.
The BBC's Quentin Somerville reporting there on one Yazidi family, now safely reunited in Germany. I'm not going to get all soppy because she would not have wanted it. Deb Cohen was a close friend who passed away Monday, And what she would have wanted is for us to play some great music right now as we remember her. Because Deb wasn't just my good friend. She worked tirelessly for decades to get musicians from around the globe to perform in this country. And she was a friend to the musicians she worked with, like Ali Farka Touré. Deb was his road manager on several tours here in the States. She made him feel at home because she had spent a lot of time with him at his home in Mali.
Donnez-nous des motopompes pour qu'on puisse quand même venir à nos besoins naturels.
Deb got to know artists like Ali personally. When he sings there that rich countries should stop giving poor countries bombs and offer water pumps instead if they really want to help, I can see Deb talking with him under a starlit sky around a fire about these crazy conditions in the world. She walked the walk, and she literally talked the talk. Deb didn't just speak several languages fluently. She could toggle between dialects, Portuguese Portuguese and Brazilian Portuguese, Parisian French and Malian French. That made people like Ali Farka Touré enormously comfortable on the road in a country he did not know. If you ever saw musicians like Ali Farka Touré, which was my initial connection to Deb, or Brazil's Caetano Veloso and Gilberto Gil, or more recently, young Ethiopian singer-songwriter Maclete Hedero, or even if you just heard their music here on the show, you have Deborah Cohen to thank for being their loving, funny, socially conscious, big-hearted chaperone from stage to stage. I'm Marco Werman. Thousands of Venezuelans have fled their country to seek refuge in neighboring Colombia, among them Venezuelan doctors, who report a disturbing number of preventable medical conditions among the migrants.
They're seeing a rise in maternal mortalities and infant mortalities, malaria, the measles, cases of HIV and syphilis.
That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The political and economic meltdown in Venezuela has disrupted the lives of pretty much everyone who lives there. It's also caused the largest migration in decades in the Western Hemisphere, as Venezuelans flee the chaos by the thousands. Many head to neighboring Colombia. Public hospitals at the Venezuela and Colombia border are struggling to keep up with the health issues of migrants there. Much like their patients, the healthcare workers need help, a lot of it. Megan Janetsky is a reporter in Medellin, and she's been covering the problems that public hospitals face in the border city of Macao, Colombia.
The Venezuelan healthcare system and the hospitals in the country are practically collapsed right now. It was like that before March. They were in the midst of this economic and political crisis. They had massive food and medicine shortages. And just when everyone thought it was the worst it could get, there were crippling blackouts that struck the country later or around early mid-March. And it just absolutely devastated these hospitals. There are very few medical resources, like medicine, for instance, things like surgeries without antibiotics. There's no lights a lot of times to perform care. So you're seeing this population fleeing Venezuela and going to Colombia for medical care.
So in Colombia, these hospitals, what are some of the major health issues that doctors are seeing that Venezuelan migrants are arriving with?
These doctors are seeing growingly complex cases. So they're seeing a spike in preventable diseases like malaria, the measles. They're seeing a rise in maternal mortalities and infant mortalities. They're seeing a surge in cases of HIV and syphilis. It's just more and more complex and honestly more grave cases showing up to their doors. Here's what Carlos Sanchez, the director of the hospital in Macao, said to me.
Esta última oleada de migrantes ya no viene tanto con la gripa, con el dolor, con la diarrea, sino que llegan con el cáncer, con la enfermedad renal crónica, con VIH, correcto.
And did you witness any cases like the ones Carlos Sanchez was just describing when you were there?
The most startling one, the most jolting one that I can think of is when I walked into the hospital's maternity ward, there was an elderly woman crying. She was holding a phone with a photo of a baby on it. And what had happened was her Venezuelan niece had gotten operated on, her pregnant niece, I might add, got operated on without antibiotics in Venezuela. And when she crossed into Colombia to give birth, they had found that she was severely, severely infected. But the problem was that they didn't have any bed space in the intensive care units. So she actually waited 5 days to see if she could get specialized care and then died while giving birth, and her baby survived.
So tragic. Already we're seeing a lot to deal with in Venezuela politically and economically. And now on top of it all, life-threatening health risk and getting transferred over to Colombia. It's certainly making it difficult for people to seek and provide for people to get health care. What did people at the hospital say they were most concerned about?
First, they told me that if the situation continues like this, if they don't get aid from, international entities or the Colombian government, which is already struggling in itself to keep pace, that they won't have the resources to care for both immigrants or Colombians. One man told me they were worried that their facilities are turning into cemeteries for the migrant population. And now they're really worried because they're seeing more violent injuries coming to their doors. They're worried that this crisis, because of the political conflicts, is entering a more volatile phase.
What do public hospitals in Colombia still need, Megan? You said earlier they need aid. What do they need? What is that aid?
The big aid they need right now, as what they've told me, is they need funds and more resources for higher level, upper level care. It's not just vaccines and basic medical resources that they need. It's going to be resources to take on these worsening diseases.
Megan Janeski telling us about an assignment she was on at a public hospital in Macau, Colombia, that's taking care of Venezuelan migrants. Thanks very much, Megan.
Yeah, thank you, Marco.
Okay, flash mobs may be a fun thing to see or to watch on YouTube, but a flash wall? A group of border wall supporters built a half-mile stretch of wall over the weekend. It's on private land in Sunland Park, New Mexico. But the local government is not a fan, and yesterday city officials issued a cease and desist order. Angela Kachurga is a border reporter for the Albuquerque Journal.
It's 18 feet high, and it looks very similar to the border barrier we have in this area right now. It has these tall pillars. Look, you can see through it, so like a fence, and
right.
they are deep into the ground. And the thing is, it's a half-mile stretch of border in Sunland Park, New Mexico, and on the other side is Annapurna, Mexico.
So this group, who built it, and why'd they do it?
So this group is known as We Build the Wall, and it is made up of various people, but the two co-founders are Dustin Stockton, he's the vice president, and the other person, the very high-profile founder, is Brian Colflage, a triple amputee and an Air Force veteran. They've been raising money through crowdsourcing since January and said they raised more than $20 million, and this stretch of wall is the first of their projects and will cost about between $6 and $8 million.
Did they say why they did this?
Dustin Stockton talked to me at the construction site about what was behind this massive effort.
We recognized the symbolic value in building it, but we also wanted to have a meaningful security impact as well.
They are very much in favor of putting up barriers. A lot of the people involved, including former Trump senior advisor Steve Bannon. If you go out to the site, you'll see not just a giant American flag, but a Trump 2020 sign. So very much in favor of pushing the idea that the president wants a wall. And if he can't get it from Congress or through an emergency declaration, that private funders will put it up. But of course, it had to be on private land in order to get this done.
So this wall is pretty much done. But the town of Sunland Park, New Mexico, is not too happy, right?
Well, it's a very tiny town. And, you know, most people are going to build something anywhere, large or small town, have to go through city ordinances, get building permits. The owner of the land dropped off his application on Friday, and the building started on Saturday. And the city of Sunland Park says that it was not approved, first of all, and does not have complete information. So said cease and desist until further notice. And so this multi-million dollar big wall is on hold for now. It's almost completely finished. In fact, there's a big unveiling and celebration scheduled at the site tomorrow. Steve Bannon and other high-profile members of this We Build the Wall team are going to be on hand.
What have people in Sunland Park said about this?
Well, you know, real concern that this happened over a long holiday weekend. It took 5 days to build. Nobody really knew what was happening. There is a group that is fighting President Trump's emergency declaration, an environmental group in this area, Southwest Environmental Center. The head of that group said it was done under the cover of night, and that the people doing it obviously don't respect the rule of law. So there's a lot of anger and concern about how this was done and done so quickly.
Angela, I know in my city, if you build something without a permit, even on private land, the authorities might well tear it down or order you to take it down. Is that a possibility with Sunland Park and this flash wall?
Well, you know, people in the town are calling for that, but the city officials are giving the company the opportunity to present the documentation. Currently, the size of walls that are approved by the city are 6 feet tall, so this is as well above that. But the We Build the Wall people say they did everything correctly, and they're going to fight any effort to have something done with what they clearly take a lot of pride in building.
Angela Kochurga with the Albuquerque Journal. Thank you. Always good to talk.
Thank you, Marco.
Knife crime has been at an all-time high in parts of the UK, and British Somali teenage boys have been disproportionately affected. That's why some mothers are sending their kids back to East Africa. They say it's safer there than in London. Rakia Ismail understands. She was born in Somalia, and she's the mayor of Islington near London.
Does the parent wait for her child to be killed, or does the parent take a decision?
A decision to send your teenage boy back to the country your family originally fled. Jamal Hassan is in London and mentors at-risk young people in the UK and in Africa. Jamal, there is a cruel irony here because many of these Somali families were seeking refuge in London, fleeing war back home. Is it really safer right now for a young black man to be in a place like Nairobi or even Mogadishu than in the UK right now?
100%. That is for sure. For the young boys, yes, there are suicide bombings that take place in certain parts of Africa. However, these are not targeted. They're not going after individuals. If you are a young 18-year-old Somalian boy wearing a hoodie, you know, you're not being targeted by these extremist groups that want to commit these atrocious acts. But in London, if you're wearing a hoodie and you fit the description, you cannot leave your area. You can only move around 2-3 miles a perimeter. As soon as you get out of that area, the boys from other areas, your life is in danger, basically.
So you're talking about gang violence in London, then?
Yes.
Mogadishu is inherently a more violent city than London, even these tough neighborhoods of London. I mean, that's the capital of Somalia. Surely they're not getting sent back to Mogadishu. I mean, there's just been a series of violent bombings this week.
You have a point. Surely Somalia is more violent, more primed for attack than the UK. However, we cannot mix two things. The things you cannot mix here, Marco, is that these kids are leaving the UK to escape knife crime or gun crime, yes? And the people that are carrying out these attacks are boys that look like them, are, you know, that are dressed like them, simply due to competition. Maybe they're selling drugs, or maybe, you know, that you looked at them in the wrong way. But when you go to Somalia, this doesn't happen. But yes, there are things that take place in Somalia and in other countries, but it doesn't mean families are putting their kids' lives in danger any more so than making them leave the UK. Because the statistics here, they're going through the roof and nobody's doing anything about it.
I'm speaking with Jamal Hassan from Somalia, who's been mentoring at-risk British Somali youth in London and in East Africa. You were sent back to Kenya as a teenager. What was your story, Jamal? Like, where were you living and why were you sent back?
When I was about 17, I was running into problems and, you know, my family sat me down and said to me, look, but the difference is this, and this is why I tried to educate parents. I had a really good relationship with my parents, and thank God I came from a complete family. I had both of my parents with me, you know. So they sat me down and said to me, look, this is what's happening around you. This is what's happening to your friends, and it's going to happen to you. So what we suggest is that go to Africa, perhaps not Somalia, go to Kenya, which is close to Somalia, see what life is like there. When you see poverty at first sight, when you see your family struggling, or when you see other young people making a life for themselves, perhaps only then you will understand the opportunities that you have in the UK. And I said, okay, fair enough. I would go. I said, if I decide that I don't want to stay, what will happen? They said, you will come back. So I went there. It was really overwhelming because I knew I wasn't going there to stay. I was only there for a short term, and I had to take in everything. And it was very difficult for me to adapt. And at the same time, you know, you have some sort of sympathy for everyone asking, begging on the streets. And as a teenager, you know, I didn't have wealth to give them. But I said to myself, one day, you know, somehow, some way, I am going to help my people, wherever they are in the world. So I came back, and that's when I've changed my path in life.
Jamal, one thing that has been aggravating the situation for young Somali men in London, and you brought this up earlier, is knife crime. I mean, the UK has guns pretty much under control, but there were 100 knife attacks in London, and 8 of those were attacks on Somali youth. And yet Somalis make up only 1% of the whole UK population. Why do you think these teenagers were targeted?
They're not targeted in particular for being Somali, but the target here is they don't have role models in their life. When you become 15, you've seen your mother suffer all those years. And what happens is people tell you, you know, if you sell drugs for me, or if you go on the streets and you rob, or you do X, Y, and Z violence, you'll make a lot of money. So the kids start to do this. When they start, you know, making money, then they realize, you know what, now I can feed my family. Now I can be the man of the house, not realizing that they're only put a ticking time bomb on themselves, which they'll either be in prison or dying.
Jamal, do you have a sense of how the British authorities are dealing with the violence in these Somali neighborhoods?
It's very difficult for the UK government to single out only Somali communities and try to target and help them, because this is a problem that's affecting UK as a whole, and in particular young black boys. But the situation with the UK government, by cutting, you know, budgets, closing our youth centres, this does not help the current climate of the epidemic knife crime, and it's only going to get worse. And I say this, as sad as it is, because I'm on the ground, I work with these kids. There are vulnerable kids that I work with, or have worked with, that have gone, they've passed away. And there are some that I work with now that are, you know, are very vulnerable, that who knows, perhaps, God forbid, in a few months, they won't be around. And that's because there's no support. So it takes people like me to leave my profession to come and start up an organization and go into a different profession, only to give back to the community. We cannot rely on the government to come and save these kids. We have to do it ourselves.
Jamal Hassan mentors young people in the UK and in Africa, many of them from Somali families. Jamal, thank you for sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thank you very much. Lovely speaking with you.
Hey there, World Podcast listener. We're creating a newsletter to help keep all of you up to date with everything we're doing in the world's newsroom. We want you to tell us what you think would be most interesting, most useful for you in a newsletter from the world. So I'm looking at you superfans to help us out and be a part of the world's newsletter focus group. I know you are some of the smartest listeners out there, so your input will be really important to have. Don't worry, it won't take a lot of time. Just send us an email to myworld@theworld.org and write newsletter in the subject line. That's myworld@theworld.org. And thanks. The federal government is holding about 50,000 migrants and asylum seekers in detention, and that number increases every day. That's more people than ever before, because the Trump administration is not releasing many of the migrants after they're apprehended. Meanwhile, the facilities that hold those detainees have become big business for private companies and some local governments. But there is increasing pushback. Cities in California and Oregon have stopped Immigration and Customs Enforcement from using local facilities like jails. And that's prompting ICE to seek out other communities where they can hold migrants in detention. The World's Rupa Shenoy takes us to one small city in Rhode Island where this has divided the community.
Central Falls is just one dense urban square mile. It's drawn immigrants for generations as a mill town. Now it's majority Latino. Next to the city high school's outdoor stadium is a brown concrete building surrounded by fences and barbed wire. That's the Donald W. Wyatt Detention Facility, known locally as the Wyatt.
It's huge. You know, you can't really miss it. I never really knew what was ever going on.
Until this past March. Daniela Magana heard about it at her high school, Blackstone Valley Prep. The Wyatt was holding 133 people for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. People were protesting outside.
We are here for you! We are here for you! We are here for you!
Magana was asked to speak at a demonstration. She'd never done anything like that before, and her parents were worried. They're from El Salvador.
One of the biggest fears is, okay, well, what if you go speak out and then somehow this comes back to us and we, you know, for whatever reason, get in trouble or, like, worst case scenario, get kicked out of the country? Like, they didn't want that.
Magana talked them down. And when she spoke, she was surrounded by city leaders.
Wyatt represents inequality. It represents inhumanity. But most importantly, Wyatt doesn't belong in Central Falls.
But it did, once, for another generation of Central Falls residents. 25 years ago, when this struggling city needed money, a detention center seemed like a good idea to then-Mayor Thomas Lazia. He's the son of Syrian and Lebanese immigrants.
I brought this facility to the city.
The Wyatt was the first in a nationwide building boom encouraged by the Clinton administration of publicly owned, privately operated adult correctional facilities. It was set up as a nonprofit corporation with a board whose members are appointed by the mayor.
The revenues that came in from the facility were first to be used for its operation, secondly, to pay the bonds, and thirdly, the city would gain any revenue if the revenues exceeded those amounts.
And the city did make money initially, more than $5 million. But that all stopped in 2008 when a detainee died as a result of medical neglect. After that, ICE canceled all its contracts with the Wyatt. The facility fell into deep debt. It tried for years to work its way out by getting back in business with ICE. It wasn't successful until earlier this year.
There is revenue to be brought to the city that this new contract was going to accomplish.
But then came the protests outside the Wyatt, followed by a move that really got people talking in Central Falls. It happened in one evening. The mayor abruptly appointed new board members.
Please raise your right hand.
And those members voted to cancel the ICE contract. They said the detainees hadn't had access to lawyers. Former Mayor Lazia was in the audience and says they had no proof.
I think the interest of Central Falls has been centered on satisfying the Hispanic population in our city and not being fiscally responsible to the entire ethnic populations in our city through proper management.
It seemed like the Central Falls protesters had been successful. ICE began moving its detainees out.
One of them looked really young. Like, he looked like he must have just turned 18.
Deborah Gonzalez directs the immigration clinic at the nearby Roger Williams University Law School. She was asked to come in to do a Know Your Rights presentation for the remaining ICE detainees, about 20 of them, wearing orange scrubs and white cloth shoes. Most told Gonzalez they'd come from the southern border. She asked them if they knew where they were.
They were like, well, it's in the U.S., so I don't think they had any concept of where that is.
She says one young man knew he was being transferred out of the Wyatt and cried because he thought he was going to be deported.
He held on to the table and he said, we don't want to leave this place, although they were just going to another facility. But I don't think they were being told where they were going.
I went to meet the Wyatt's warden, Daniel Martin. He says what people don't understand is that detainees are treated really well at the Wyatt.
Staff here are very responsive to detainees' needs. That's not always the case in other correctional systems and stuff, you know.
Martin says he's used to locals misunderstanding what he does.
Very simply, you just have to kind of educate them, you know, and educate them and inform them as to what, you know, what we do and how we do it. We would hope they would, you know, support the fact that we don't control who's housed there. Unfortunately, this is a business that's misinterpreted.
A misinterpreted business, maybe, but still powerful. The Wyatt's bondholders struck back forcefully. They sued the city, and there was a quick reversal once federal courts got involved. In late April, a federal judge ruled the Wyatt board couldn't cancel the ICE contract. It was reinstated. ICE started sending detainees back.
So they returned, you know, a large number again. And we have been pretty much just business as usual. You know, we're hopeful that things remain as they are.
The judge made it clear he would be overseeing the future conduct of everyone involved.
You know, you always want different results, but I think you have to be happy and knowing that at least steps were made to assure people's rights.
The current Central Falls mayor, James Diosa, is the son of a former undocumented immigrant.
I owe a lot to him. Just as he explained to me, to find the courage to leave everything behind, it was a risk he was willing to take for survival and to be able to provide for his future family, which is us. So this hits me on so many levels.
With news of children dying in detention facilities, he says having more oversight for the Wyatt helps him sleep at night.
Mayors, since they're on the front lines, they have to deal with these issues. And I think if leaders don't stand up, matters are going to get worse.
But it's an unsatisfying ending for high schooler Daniela Magana. She understands things can't change completely overnight.
You know, you can't just one day then be locked up, the next day then be released. Like, it doesn't work that quickly, especially because of, you know, the government that we have and the society that we live in.
But with cities like Central Falls at least fighting back, ICE will have to work harder to figure out where to house its detainees.
I'm just hoping that, like, there's actually a victory.
For The World, Rupa Shenoy, Central Falls, Rhode Island.
And that's where we leave it today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.